First ever episode of the Feedback Loop with Sino Global Capital. I'm the host, Matthew Graham, and here today with Samuel Bankman-Fried, who famously is the CEO of Alameda Research, the CEO of FTX, and also the founder of Serum. Sam, thanks so much for you being here on our first ever episode.
Of course, thanks for having me.
Awesome. So Sam, in addition to those three amazing entrepreneurial things, what else would be super interesting to learn about you? Just a general question to start us off.
I'm sure that really what you guys want to know is, what football games I'm planning to watch this Sunday. I know that's big on your mind some days, but outside of the obvious things, I most of my life these days is spent working. But there are a few other things which are quite important to me. I think probably the biggest one is effective altruism, which is sort of how I got, started down my career path in the first place. And it is sort of, long-term what sort of my goal is.
So this is one of the things that I really hoped to learn more about from you today. And I actually researched this in advance of the pod, because this was a term that I had heard before and kind of had a rough sense of what it's all about, but I really want to learn more. And so from my research, effective altruism is how can we individually and collectively do the most good as a basic fundamental question. Does that sound about right?
I think, yeah, that's basically right. And I think it's often invoked in like a kind of more specific sense of, within this sort of type of action or industry or whatever. But really in the end, it is the more general one of, across the space of all things anyone could do. What are the good things and what are the best things?
So my understanding is this is a fairly recent movement. Does that sound correct? I'm reading that it was promulgated by Peter Singer and affiliated with an earning to give movement. From my research, it seemed like this is really something that has come about or at least become much more prominent in the last 10 years or so. Does that sound right?
Yeah, it's basically right. And, there's sort of like, little mini strains of it and sort of things that reflected some of its features before that. But, effective altruism as like a movement or a community or sort of like term or recognized body of thought really did sort of come about, in the last decade or so.
Got it. And so how would it be different from something like utilitarianism? Help me understand what this looks like in practice, because it really sounds like right. It's a fundamental organizing principle for you and something that's really core for you. So I'm really jazzed to learn more.
Yeah. So, utilitarianism, just for, those listening, it's probably going to sound pretty similar. It's sort of a philosophy, which is, try and maximize the sort of aggregate good in the world and, take whatever actions get you there. And sort of there's a bunch of different flavors of it that you basically get when you start drilling down into, okay, what you mean by, good, and there's sort of various divides on like, well, how about animals? Like which animals do they matter? How about like pain and happiness? How about like the future people or people who don't exist and there's sort of like lots of like ways you can dig into that. But that utilitarianism as a philosophy has been around for a few centuries. And, not every effective altruist is utilitarian, but many are, including myself. And in many ways, EA is to many people is sort of like applied utilitarianism. It's, okay, so you're a utilitarian, that's sort of like the theory, but like, what does that actually imply? Like, what should you actually do because of that? And it's sort of in many ways, a body of work, sort of designed to answer like the actual practical question of like, what we should do with our lives, given, you know, a sort of utilitarianism or you know, a background that's sort of either utilitarian or sort of like, you know, sympathetic to utilitarianism.
So is it fair to say in practice, this looks like, hey, I'm a physics student at MIT and I can basically do whatever, I can go in whatever direction I want to. But this is my organizing principle. So I'm going to go into the field where I can make the most money. Why? Because I can then simultaneously or perhaps later make the most impact by taking those proceeds and investing in this organizing principle EA. Is that practically what it looks like for many people and kind of what it looks like for you?
Yeah, I think that's basically right. And that's, you know, there's sort of a bunch of different directions it can lead, but that's one of them. That's, you know, one of the more prominent ones. And it's sort of the direction that I've been going down of, and, you know, sort of like one of the thought experiments that generates this is like, you know, you have some, whatever, some movement, something, some charity that you think is like, you know, plausibly doing, you know, the most good. And I'm not saying this is what I'd necessarily say, but, you know, one thing you say is like, all right, how about like, you know, something devoted to sub-Saharan Africa and public health and, you know, malaria control there. And why would you choose that? Well, one thing you could ask is like, which charity saves the most lives per dollar? And that's a really hard question because you can start to say, well, how about a climate change charity? Is that going to save everyone? Maybe let's put that aside for a second. Not that it doesn't matter, but let's say that like, just as a toy example, you said, no, that's not what I mean. You know what I mean, right? Like actually like Jim, like, you know, I can like point to the people it saved or something like that. And, you know, when you start for strict to kind of, you know, the most straightforward applications, one of the things that pops up is things like malaria control in various parts of the world. And you know, you can do various studies which sort of make it seem like it's some number of single digit thousands of dollars per life saved through those. And so, you know, you could say, all right, let's say that's, you know, what I want to sort of devote my life to, like, you know, sort of go to that charity to, you know, against malaria foundations, one of them, and say, all right, like your choice. I'm just going to do what's best for you guys. You can do the most good. I'm happy to show up for work, you know, on Monday for you guys, or I'm happy to go work for this other kind of high paying job I have lined up and donate, you know, what I make to you guys, like, which would you prefer? And you know, if you're sort of like, you know, you know, like really good at sort of like applied public health and field organizing and really understand, you know, the culture in Africa, like there's some like properties of you, or maybe like, yeah, I'd actually be like a really baller employee for them. Like I could add a ton of capacity. And if instead you're like, all right, like, honestly, like I'd be kind of shit at that, but like, I actually sort of like am in a position where I could donate a lot. You know, you can start to get to the point where like, oh, all right, well, I could have one mediocre employee or enough money to hire, you know, whichever 20 employees I want. Like, yeah, let's choose the second one.
So for a certain, if I'm hearing you correctly, and that actually was a follow-up question I had, but you already got to it. If I'm understanding you correctly, for a certain kind of person, it might, depending on their skill set, it might make more sense for them to go directly into, for example, public health, or developing some kind of sustainable, environmentally sustainable solution, something like that. But for a person with another type of skill set, it makes more sense to go into something that allows them to have the capacity to fund these type of projects. Is that understanding correct?
Okay. Yeah, that's exactly right. And you know, there's sort of a million paths you can take, and in the end, obviously, you should filter for ones that are generically high impact, but also ones where you're going to be able to sort of maximize those particular paths.
Sure, that makes sense. Interesting, actually, that you mentioned malaria control. Malaria is, if I recall correctly, that's famously one of the frontline initiatives of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Do you view EA as kind of the next iteration of the Buffett and Gates philosophy of I'm going to give away most of my wealth during my lifetime rather than inheritance? Do you view this as kind of the successor of that philosophy?
in a lot of ways I do. And I think that you can see a lot of things in what they do that are sort of like, you know, I would see a sort of proto EA and see them as, you know, doing a lot of things pretty well, making a lot of really powerful and moral decisions. And I think, you know, they don't tend to be super maximizing. You know, it tends to be sort of more of a spray and pray and, you know, including some great programs, some really kind of like, you know, pretty useless programs. And then a lot that are like impressive at what they do, but seem really unlikely to be like chosen because they had the highest impact or anything like that. And so it's sort of like has a lot of the elements, but, you know, not others of those. And I think this is sort of like, all right, how about that? But like more intentional and more like, you know, not just doing a bunch of things that seem pretty good, but thinking about like, all right, which of these are actually like the real standouts?
Well, this is interesting, actually, because Buffett, I know, for example, the main thing I know about Buffett, and again, this is if I recall correctly, but he has a plan to give away most of his wealth. And if I recall correctly, famously, he said that for his kids, they needed, you know, $1 million each, something like that, so they could do,
yep,
you know, kind of whatever they wanted. And that was his basic. He's just kind of... I guess the contrast I want to make is Gates, for example, I had thought of as really the most impactful major philanthropist on the planet. It seems like he's put tremendous thought into this. How can he get the most bang for the buck for his donations, things like that? But if I heard you correctly just now, it sounds like you think there is actually major room for improvement in his approach. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, again, I think he does better than 98% of people at this. But I think one thing which generally seems to be true in a lot of areas of the world is that like there are sort of these power laws, and an enormous fraction of all the impact is really in the tails. And you know, the difference between doing a bunch of things that seem pretty good and thinking hard about which seem like the best and doing those is often pretty massive. You know, it's sort of not like, yeah, that's pretty good, that's good enough. It often sort of seems like you just get an enormous amount of juice for going the extra mile, and that, you know, well, I'm sort of like excited about most of what he's doing. You know, sort of like only 5% of it actually ends up in the things that I think have like the biggest, you know, really the biggest impact.
Reminds me of a VC portfolio.
Exactly. It's sort of like VC profile that just like, you know, puts a little bit in everything and like, you know, as opposed to like, you know, super targeted thesis driven VC portfolio or something.
Sure. But power law, I guess, is what I was referring to.
Yeah. Oh, I see. Yeah.
So this is actually super interesting to me because I think of Gates as... alluded to this already, but I really think of him as the gold standard for what he has done with his philanthropy. But can you tell me more what you think he has done super well, and but especially where you think he could have done things differently? It sounds like you think it too much spray and pray and less thesis driven. Is that part of it?
Yeah, that's basically right. And I think, you know, things he's done well, I think he's put an enormous amount of wealth into, you know, some extremely promising global health charities. I think like, you know, malaria is like an example where he's done a ton, and there are a bunch of other ones. And in fact, you look at a decent fraction of what seem like, you know, the most impactful of these global health charities, and they're pretty big in a lot of them. And so I think that like, in terms of being like, you know, pretty good at those. Now, of course, when I say pretty good, you know, it's only like, I have no idea what, like a few percent of his, of what he's giving away or something. He's, you know, he has so much money that like, you know, it's still like, yeah, you know, just a couple billion. And so I think that, I mean, there's a question of whether those are the most impactful thing, but, you know, I think they are quite good. But I think that, you know, first of all, it sort of like, doesn't at all seem like he's thought about what the single most important thing is. And like, you know, if you think really hard and decide it doesn't turn out to be global health charities, then like, you know, then it turns out it's just whiffed on it. But the other things you look at sort of, you know, the entire rest of the portfolio, and it's just a lot of things that seem like, you know, not crazy, like, oh yeah, you know, that's like a real charity, but like, you know, sort of all over the place, right? Like there's like, you know, these various like sort of random education things and arts things, and there's like, you know, various diseases he's funding that seem really likely to not be, you know, kind of really likely to be like large money sinks without a huge impact. And he's just sort of like active in like everything to some extent.
Right. And do you think with, that, go ahead.
I was just saying,
yeah, I have that bad habit of interrupting with people. my terrible bad habit. It's the first time it came up. I'm trying to unlearn my interrupting people habit. Please go ahead.
But yeah, you know, sort of like nothing, like you sort of look at it and it's clear that there's nothing, which is like the thing he's thought hard about and decided he sort of really thinks is exceptional.
So do you think that's possibly related to capacity, related to the fact that he has so much capital to deploy for his philanthropy?
It's a really good question. And I don't, although I think that it's, I think you need to think a while to convince yourself that it's not that. Mm. Because he has what, I don't know, 100 billion or something like that. And I don't remember what he has now, but you know, something like that, 50, you know, 50 billion. and it's a lot of money. I mean, that's sort of like hilariously more money than like anyone you'll ever meet.
Yeah.
And you can sort of like put it on various scales in which it seems like, you know, like one thing I sometimes think about is like units of things you might consume, like, you know, bagels or
okay.
or like Uber rides or something like that. And you can kind of put it on that scale and be like, okay, he could just buy every bagel in the world, you know, like he literally could have all the bagels. Like it's sort of like, you can't put his wealth on that scale. But the thing is that like his goal, you know, when you're sort of donating, your goal isn't constrained by how much you consume. It's constrained by the world. And you get this factor of 7 billion there, right? And so like one easy thing you could do is just divide by 7 billion what he has, and then you're left with like, you know, $10 or whatever. That's how much he has per person in the world. And so when you think about like, if you're really trying to change the world with your money, ideally, and you got 10 bucks a person, it sort of like immediately becomes obvious that at least you're not like obviously like, you know, completely like beyond what there's any capacity to have impact with, right? Like if you're just trying to give people money to make their lives better, you don't have enough. Like, and that clearly is something you can do, right? Just like take everyone in the world who clearly doesn't have enough money, and there's a lot of people in that bucket, you know, and you know, everyone who's going to have to worry about food in their life, about being able to, you know, feed themselves and their family, and like, you know, give them the thousands of dollars that they need to take a lot of that, you know, to allow them to kind of like really be able to live their life. And all of a sudden you've already gotten beyond his wealth. And so when you scale things up to the scale of the world, all of a sudden the amount of money that things can consume is really, really big. And, you know, there's sort of other things that show this, you know, like the United States government. I don't want to paint it as like the most optimized thing in the world. It certainly isn't. It's like pretty random in a lot of places, but it sort of sees itself as having the goal of like doing as at least as much good as it can for its citizens, you know. And it spends like what, $1 trillion a year or something
maybe,
like that.
Maybe.
Right.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, at least that's what it tries to do. I mean, whether or not you think it does it, right?
Yeah, maybe.
Go ahead. But that's $1 trillion a year. That's every year 20 times as much as what he has. And clearly, you know, the government runs out of money. Like the government doesn't have, it's not like $1 trillion is so much money they can't figure out what to do with it. So when you scale up to like really the world scale, just the amount that you can sink into things is really, really large. And you can just find single projects. You know, if you want to do something like prevent climate change, as an example, you know, I don't think Bill Gates has enough money to fight that battle on his own.
Okay, so for sure, one thing that generated a lot of follow-up questions. So for one thing, for sure, while you were rapping just now, it makes me wonder if you think that income inequality is to what extent you think that's a major problem. You're mentioning a lot of how much just one person like Bill Gates could consume or things like that. Is that something that you view as a frontline problem?
Sort of. And I think what I'd say is two things. The first is that
wealth inequality, it's right. Rather than income inequality. Yeah. I should make that a very important distinction.
And you know, I think there's I'll sort of give two riffs on it. The first is that I think everyone sort of has a little bit of a myopic view on it. And everyone sort of takes a reference class around them and defines inequality as like the people one rung below them versus the people one rung above them. And so you have sort of, you know, middle class American who's like, you know, income inequality is like, you know, $25,000 a year of income versus $100,000 a year of income as like poor versus rich. And that sort of sounds totally natural until you kind of zoom out and you're like, wait, but that $25,000 a year is like more than almost anyone makes in some countries, right? And so like there's sort of this broader thing of like, and like basically no one's starving in the United States, right? Like that's sort of like one test of this and so then it's like, oh, what does wealth inequality mean? Does it actually just mean like rich countries versus poor countries, or like where do you draw the line? And so that's one thing that I would say is I think like a lot of people work on things that sort of could be described as this, but I think like miss what are like probably the biggest numbers here. And if what you're trying to do is just like make people's lives better right now, like, you know, if you sort of like don't think very hard about like future flow through effects and your goal is just like make the world better this year, then I think that like it's actually fairly compelling to just give a bunch of money to the poorest people. And the reason is like, you know, first of all, like, you know, $1,000 someone who's extremely poor might be the difference between them like starving and them having plenty to eat. And that's like an enormous change in their life. And so, you know, you can get pretty good, you can scale that up pretty big. And then the other thing is just super simple, super clean. And there's sort of this thing of like whatever other thing you're going to do, like, you know, whatever kind of global health thing, you can imagine just giving them money and then they do the health thing. It's going to be less efficient, right? Because like you get economies of scale for doing it, but like maybe you get to within a factor of three or four of it. And so, you know, I think that like it at least means that like, you know, kind of global wealth inequality is at least a really important thing as in terms of like current welfare of the world. And that, you know, it's at least not a crazy thing to do to focus on that. Although I think that the case is a hell of a lot stronger for that than it is for wealth inequality within some narrow subset of the world's wealth band, as sort of ever intends to do. So that's sort of the first answer that I'll give. The second thing, though, is that one of sort of the big divides in how people see these things there's a lot of ways to phrase it. One is like sort of the now versus the future, speculative versus proven. There's sort of like a lot of words that get thrown here that are all sort of like allied with each other in various ways, but generally the shtick is like, what's the right way to think of it? Is it basically like you got all these people, like you try and figure out how happy they are now, and then you can do some intervention and see how happy everyone is, and like, you know, try and maximize that process? Or do you say like, let's zoom out on the timeline and say, what can we do that's going to affect the long run course of the world? Like, what's going to have a sort of, you know, enduring impact 1,000 years from now? And the argument for the first is like, well, the argument for the second is that there's this gigantic number, which is like the number of people in the future, that like, you know, if you can do something that really changes the course of the world, it doesn't just affect people alive now, it affects everyone who will ever live. And that's just this massively larger number than sort of almost anything else you can get to. And the argument for sort of the other approach of trying to just help people here today is like, it actually fucking works. And like, you know, kind of a really healthy dose of skepticism towards someone who says that they can predict what will, you know, the effect of their actions 1,000 years in the future with any amount of predictive power. And so I think that a lot of what this comes down to, there's some philosophical things like, do you care about people who aren't born yet or something? But I think in the end, the biggest thing that this really comes down to is like, do you actually realistically think that's plausible that you're going to be able to do something now, which you can predict in expectation will have a really positive impact on the long run view of the world? Or is that just impossible to figure out?
Interesting. So there's a lot to unpack there. One thing I wanted to push back on, and one thing also that I really like, I do want to push back on, I believe it to not be correct that there are not a substantial number of starving people in the United States. I believe that to be a false statement. I would push back on that pretty hard if we and we could.
You're probably right. It's not substantial compared to the world's population of starving people. But it is substantial in and of itself. Yeah, I agree.
But the one thing that I really liked and that I very much agree with is that if you start talking about wealth inequality, that there are different ways to slice that, and it, the picture in terms of changing wealth inequality, the picture in a number of different ways will look very different. If you look at wealth inequality, for example, within the United States versus wealth inequality on a worldwide basis. Of course, a lot of that is also skewed by the rise of China, and but long story short, it looks very different if you look within a country versus versus between countries or worldwide. I definitely agree with that. So you mentioned, going back to some other things that I wanted to pick up more, you mentioned that it sounded like you weren't completely convinced that to the extent that Bill Gates has an overarching thesis, you weren't 100% convinced, if I understood correctly, that public health was the right choice. Did I understand that correctly, or?
That's right. And I think it has a really strong case under some views of things, but not under others. And I think that, I mean, different people have sort of different opinions on that. I've sort of my opinions on it. But.
So if that's not... So I definitely agree that's not, this is not something I have thought a lot about myself. So you'll have to be patient while I work this through as we talk. So it definitely doesn't seem like a layup that should be the number one overarching imperative for a philanthropist. That's not obvious to me either.
Right. It's clearly a plausible candidate, but it's also obviously the right one.
Exactly. So I have not, but maybe you have. Have you thought, if not public health, what would you have as your top or top three imperatives? Let's upsize. Let's say if you were heading up Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, if you had gone into that field and already made a splash, and now you're the head of the foundation, and have carte blanche. What are your top three imperatives?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So, again, this is just my opinion, and smart people really disagree on this. Like, there isn't a consensus, and I'm not confident. I'm sort of, just making a ton of judgment calls and approximations here. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a lot of reasonable answers you can come to. I still think there's a lot of things which are pretty hard to justify on these grounds. You could justify them on personal consumptive grounds, but but I'll give sort of a few answers, and I don't want to necessarily say these exactly would be my three, because there's some things that are just like too weird and wacky and sort of like ill-defined to even like be a candidate right now, but that like might end up being extremely big. And I'm sort of going to put those aside and talk about like things that I at least like have fleshed out well enough that they would like make sense as sort of a proposal. And, I'll first sort of just give a brief tour of things. I mean, there's public health things, which are very good on the like current human lives, very likely saved per dollar front. There's animal welfare charities, which are very good on the like lives saved per dollar front, or, happiness or torture per dollar front. If you think that animals, matter, or how much they matter, or which animals do. Then you get to sort of this like general mishmash of far future things. And, one of these is looking at stopping bioterrorist threats as like a sort of like not very heavily studied thing that in 20 years could plausibly be very terrifying. If if you know, synthesizing custom chemicals becomes way more powerful, which it probably will. And it's sort of one thing which is plausibly in the category of like what could just completely fuck the world, like not just be bad, but like be kind of unrecoverable.
Right. Sure.
And so there's that. There's climate change, just on the list. The big downside of it is that it just has a ton of attention already and a ton of resources already being thrown at it. So sort of the lowest hanging fruit, maybe isn't there. And then there's there's sort of like a locus of things around artificial intelligence, which is variants on like what could you do now to try and push it such that if we ever build a super powerful AI, that it'll be like more likely to be good and less likely to be bad.
I thought the super powerful AI was you. That's not you.
That's just it's actually pretty dinky compared to
Okay.
And so that's one of the big ones in ineffective altruism, on the grounds that it's like among technologies right now that where it's not clear how they're going to play out, but they have a pretty decent chance of really changing the world forever. You know, AI is like way up there on that list. And so that's sort of like a pretty typical selection of things that people will bring up, and a bunch of variants on those. I'll maybe give some comments and also a few other kind of like things that I think about. I generally think that the argument for far future stuff is quite strong if you can come up with a compelling...
Sorry, the argument for what?
For the far future stuff.
Oh, the far future stuff. Sure.
Mm-hmm. I generally think the argument is quite compelling if you can convince yourself that you can find something that matters. Mm. Just the amount of leverage that you can get from something that could really help the entire future is just so enormous that if you can do it, which is quite hard, you don't have to make that, you don't have to kind of like move the needle that much to have a really massive impact. And so if you could, you know, have a 0.01% chance of averting a catastrophic event that would basically destroy the world, that would be an unbelievably large impact. Mm. You know, you don't need to have a 50% swing here, like just nudging it if you can do so. And so I think the argument for thinking hard about AI is quite good. I think that there's like a decent chance that we build an extremely powerful transformative AI sometime the next century. And that, you know, it's going to matter quite a bit how we do that and what it's sort of built to do and how it's managed. And so I think that's like way up there. I think that I think there's like decent arguments for some bio stuff. And I guess some other things that I've been thinking about quite a bit are, and maybe I'll turn this on you, which people over the last 10 years, 20 years, you know, have had the most impact on the long run course of the world?
Oof, that is a tough question. So, in a positive way or a negative way?
Impact either way, but only, right? Only a negative one if you could imagine the opposite of that. So, like, you know, mass murder doesn't count because you can't be like a mass anti-murder.
Well, mass murder, but like, yeah, mass murder wouldn't even.
It wouldn't even register.
It wouldn't even qualify, right. No matter what. Yeah. That is an extremely tough question. I would have to think about that very, very hard.
It's going to be really hard.
It would probably get very political very quickly. I think when you start talking about those types of things, that if you say single person most impact,
it'd be kind of weird if Trump and Obama weren't on the list, right? Like, no matter what you think of them, they've certainly got to be in the top 20, right? And probably G and you know, like a few other world leaders as well. And I think that's a really good point, is like you ask anyone and everyone will say, I have no idea. And then you press them to like, well, okay, obviously, like here's like five people who are obviously on the list.
Well, I'll tell you what we could do. We could push it back. I'd be more comfortable discussing this if we pushed it back 10, 20 years.
Yeah, so, sure. So let's talk about,
certainly, I think the, to give an example, the decision to invade Iraq was just a colossal blunder that, in my view, my strongly held view, that created immense suffering for an enormous amount of people. And so if you certainly could also go back a step earlier and say, well, you know, 9/11, but then you certainly could say Iraq. These are decisions that had enormous negative impact. I do think, unfortunately, it's easier to have negative impact than positive impact, or maybe I'm just a pessimistic person.
I'm not sure. You're right.
I tend to think so, right? Easier to fuck things up than to...
Because the world like mostly works and people try and make it work. And so like that's the norm. And you know, what's the biggest deviation you get from the norm? Almost no one tries to wreck shit. And so it's just like a huge huge difference versus trying to do good things a bit better. I agree. I think like, you know, you can look at some like foreign policy probably matters. I mean, you can sort of look at the history of significant foreign policy events over the last century, even, right? Yeah. With World War One, World War Two, the Cold War, you know, the various Middle East misadventures, and like clearly those had long-term impact, you know, and you know, maybe, yeah, and you know, like, I think where that starts to lead you is, okay, you can kind of trace through how things impacted that, but you've at least started to paint a picture of some people who fall on this list, right? Like world leaders or people who influence them or people who influence the technology that, you know, like anything that sort of flows through that pipeline is at least like a candidate here, right? Like at least we sort of like found people who probably did have quite large long-term impact. And, you know, I think there's probably some other people, like there's a few scientific advancements that probably did, right? Like pasteurization, maybe, you know, like really core things, you know, germ theory. I mean, you know, computer, the internet, like things that led to the creation of that had plausibly quite large impact. If you don't think they're inevitable, I don't have strong views on whether they were.
Sure, I mean, a lot of these things become very chaotic once you
once you
trace it back further enough, and then you think, well, I mean, it quickly becomes a very philosophical discussion, actually.
It quickly does. And about,
go ahead.
Yeah, but at some level, I think it does. You know, it's at some level becomes like kind of really hard to tell, but at some level, you can at least have like some opinions. And
exactly.
So,
yeah, sure thing.
You know, I think one thing that points to is that, like, you know, politics probably does matter. I think there's sort of like this like naive view that politics matters. And then there's sort of this like smart contrarian like take of like, oh, come on, like stop bickering, guys. This is all irrelevant. And then
I think you already know that though.
Right. I know that, you know, but I think a lot of really smart people do. They do that because they see a lot of really stupid bickering in politics. They're like, what's the point of this? And the bickering is really stupid, but you know, they're bickering over things that matter, like a $1 trillion budget each year and, you know, a nuclear arsenal. And and you know, these things actually matter quite a bit. And so, you know, I think that things that flow through that, you know, frankly, who could you put on this list? I mean, I think you could make a decent argument for the Koch brothers.
I think you could too. I mean, they've been just a low-key, steady burn clusterfuck.
Yeah,
they're just, I can't think, I mean, just horrible people, honestly, in my view. I'll go on the record.
And, you know, I think like, you know, some people probably...
Strong answer.
Right. I think, you know, probably some people think they've done great things, but I think most people probably should think they've at least done big things, you know, that like they have.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think that's not to say it's necessarily the biggest thing, but, you know,
that's,
I will say it's
a very, very strong answer, actually. I think that's,
So in light of, you know, what's sort of coming up upon us in God, a few weeks.
Maybe a more US-centric answer.
It's a US-centric answer, but you know, clearly, at least in the US, this matters, and clearly that spills out to the world.
Yep.
And so I think, you know, the US political process, it matters. And I think in particular, you sort of like, you think about like, okay, sure, you could like you know, change one state senator, does that matter much? Nah, you know, on the long scheme, not really. I think that's like really fat tailed. Like, you know, I think this isn't, you know, it's sort of like a few big things have huge impact. And if you, a few decisions, if you key people end up, you know, really influential there. I mean, Comey, yep. Right? Like Comey had massive impact sort of accidentally. So it's not just the people themselves, but I think that,
you know, the timing of RBG's, pass,
exactly.
You know?
Yeah. These things, they matter. And so I think, like, you know, that's sort of like one other avenue, which I think is like, you know, people sometimes say like, oh, there's so much money in politics. It's actually sort of surprising how little there is. You sort of do the math, you're like, all right, like it's $1 billion spent each cycle. And for $1 trillion a year budget, oh, wow. Okay. You know, maybe that $1 billion isn't that big anymore. So I think that's, you know, one plausible answer here. I think that there's building transformative technologies does have a real track record of having impact on the world. Now, so a little bit, you have to further think that you're going to have positive impact. And so I think it just blindly building them, it's not clear if that's positive. Maybe it is. Maybe it robustly is. But at the very least, I think you probably want to be thinking about that and what your goal is with it. But that has, in some cases, had pretty huge impact on the world. And sure. I think that there, you know, there are a few other people, but and a few other paths that have. I think this is like a pretty, you know, I think it sort of like highlights at least a few things that should be on your short list of like things you're thinking about.
Sure, that makes sense. Going back to one thing you mentioned when we talked about top line priorities, I think it was the second thing you mentioned. You mentioned with regards to animals. And that reminds me that when I was reading about effective altruism, there is a, as I understand, a school of thought within EA that an EA approach should take into account the suffering of non-human animals, as Wikipedia phrased it. I only got to Wikipedia level. I didn't read the first material, but Wikipedia says
Wikipedia is pretty good.
Yeah. And so I was wondering if that is related. I don't know a whole lot about veganism or vegetarianism. Is it a dietary preference, or is it related to your EA that you, if I recall correctly, you are a vegan?
I am. And it is related to you. I mean, it was certainly not a dietary preference. My dietary preference is steak. I am vegan. I've been vegan for about 8 years, and yeah, it's exactly what you say. It's like, you know, sort of the condition of animals in factory farms is quite bad. I mean, it's sort of like, you know, horrifically worse than like basically anything that sort of you contend with in your life. And it's sort of an interesting example. First of all, you have to decide whether animals do matter and whether they can feel anything. And there's sort of like a lot of somewhat murky scientific research on that. I think it sort of points to like, yeah, many of them very likely do. Some of them kind of unclear. Some of them probably don't. You know, cows seem pretty likely to. Chickens probably do. You know, fish, it's like, it's a little bit unclear. Kind of, you start to get into pretty hairy water there, scaly water. So that's sort of the first piece. I you know, personally think it's pretty likely that at least a number of them do. And then you have this interesting thing where you sort of do a naive calculation, give you a really big number. I mean, there's sort of more animals tortured on factory farms each year than there are people in the world. And that's just like a big number. I mean, it's a big and not good number. To revise something I said earlier, I personally think that if your goal is sort of like maximize for the next month, I actually think that like animal welfare is probably the place to look. It's just like the scale of the problem there is just enormous, and it's eminently solvable. Like it's, you know, not having factory farms is not an unsolvable problem. You just don't do it. You know, that's, I think a lot of people say, okay, fine, but like, how about like, you know, nice farms, like with happy cows, and yeah, it's a totally different story, but it's also worth noting that, as it turns out empirically, like, you know, 90 something percent of animal products come from factory farms. So it's on the scale of what the world's doing right now, it's sort of like we're mostly not using the happy farms because they're, you know, less cheap. You have to pay for space for the cows. That sort of like is, you know, one of the trade-offs there. But on the flip side, if you're sort of thinking about like what will impact the long run course of the world, I think that the case there is a lot murkier. I think it's like a lot harder to make the case that it clearly is, you know, has sort of massive long-term impact beyond or massive long-term compounding effects or reshaping the future of the world beyond the sort of like specific, extremely valuable thing that it can do. And so I think that's like one thing that I think really splits down, you know, are you sort of like taking the world as it is now and trying to do better for it, or are you thinking about the world as it might be, and thinking about really when you project out to where we're going, what can you do that might impact that whole timeline?
Right. Just thinking about David Attenborough's, I guess his name is, his new movie, Life on Our Planet, is very powerful, by the way, dealing with a lot of these themes, climate change, our relationship with nature. Obviously, he's a famous explorer, but also animal lover. It really a kind of a powerful testament to his, he called it actually a kind of witness statement after a lifetime of exploration, a testament, a witness statement of his concerns about man's relationship with the environment and the in nature. You're running three companies, so you probably don't have time to watch, but for anyone listening,
you'd be surprised. I have to sort of like take periods sometimes to chill out, and but I also want to be available in case that shit happens. Yeah. So I actually will often just sort of like be at my computer on five screens. I'll have monitors up, and on the sixth, I'll just pull up Netflix and sort of chill out, but, you know, have like, blink over to the other screens every minute or so to see if I'm needed.
I can't help but notice, you know, the reason I notice is because we're somehow on the same sleep. We're both on the same time zone, and we're both frequently up at like 4 a.m, I've noticed.
Yeah, it's, you know, one of the brutal facts of being in an industry where there are people in different time zones that you have to take calls with.
Exactly. Yeah. And for some reason, I just have found that that's the most.
Yeah.
I think part of it's my natural rhythm, my natural sleep rhythm, I guess. But I think also for whatever reason, being on Hong Kong time, Beijing time, and being in our chaotic industry, somehow that ends up being the most convenient schedule to be able to sync with people from around the world.
Yeah, totally agree.
I had more about EA. So going back, I was wondering the genesis of this.
Yeah.
Because it's so important to you. And I was wondering if it's related, and you can blast me if I'm wrong. I know, if I recall, you like Slate Star Codex, and I was wondering if EA's genesis as a core organizing principle for you is related to that famous Silicon Valley blog. I am not that familiar with it, but I'm told it's famous. is it related to that, or is it...
Right, so... Genesis? Yeah, it came in the other order for me, actually. So I was a utilitarian growing up, and I did fuck all about it for, you know, 18 years. But you sort of got to college and you know, for the first time, actually started to think about what am I going to do with my life?
Well, hold on, I do want to interrupt for once. I have to say, I think only a philosopher or lawyer's kid would say I was a utilitarian growing up.
Yeah, I was raised in one of the few utilitarian families in this world.
okay, I had to interrupt, so please go ahead. Yeah,
and so I, you know, sort of got to college, didn't really know what I was doing with my life, and and you know, sort of had to contend with that, and contend with the fact that my plan of, I don't know, maybe professor or something, wasn't really panning out. And so, you know, so I started thinking about what to do with my life, and ended up taking some deep dives into some Wikipedia articles and meeting some sort of like-minded folk. And I sort of got, you know, pretty into animal welfare. My freshman year, you know, went vegan then, and and then sort of branched out, you know, Googled around, found some blogs, and and was sort of like tangentially getting it into EA, and then one day, Will McCaskill, who is sort of the, you know, head of the Center for Effective Altruism, was visiting Boston, and I got lunch with him, and sort of sat down and for the first time actually talked about, like, you know, what am I doing with my life? Sort of had no idea, and he gave some suggestions, and I think that was like, that was really the start of me, like, actually thinking about this as it applied to my life more generally, and so I, you know, started thinking about it more, and earning to give seemed like a pretty promising career path for me. So I you know, had some friends who had interned at James Root's, a quant trading firm, and, you know, decided to give it a shot. So I interned there, after my junior year, and then started full time when I graduated.
Awesome. Got it. You know, I had so many other questions. We have 9 minutes left. Do you want to do rapid fire? What do you think?
Yeah, let that sounds good.
Okay. So this is like a grab bag. So San Francisco, Boston, New York, Hong Kong. I remember you said that you felt kind of out of place in New York. Where do you identify? West Coast, San Francisco. East Coast, Hong Kong, San Francisco. Okay. Ever had imposter syndrome?
Yeah, frequently.
Frequently? Still, I was expecting you to say, you know, when you were 8 years old or something.
I mean, whenever I sort of leave the office and no longer have people who are sort of, you know, forced to pretend they like me, it's, you know, it sort of comes back, so.
You mentioned once in a tweet or on a pod that one of your mentors and most admired people was your boss at Jane Street. Tell us about that.
He was a really great boss. He was a great trader. Taught me and the rest of us quite a bit, and you know, really cared about the desk and the company, also cared about us, and you know, was sort of really generous and excited about us and excited about, you know, what I was doing, and you know, really sort of did what he could to empower me, and it was, I don't know, he just I really set the tone for the desk, and was sort of, you know, everyone sort of followed that, and it was just, you know, a really cooperative, intense, productive, you know, critical thinking desk, and a really nurturing one for the right people.
Got it. We're doing rapid fire, so let's speed it up.
Yeah, all right.
I got so many questions I want to ask. When's the last time you felt, oh wow, I am definitely not the smartest man in the room? When's the last time?
When's the last time that I what?
Felt, I am definitely not the smartest man in the room. When's the last time?
I mean, definitely, like, you know, I think certainly at Jane Street it happened a number of times. And there's like things in which it happens to me now, and I think certainly, like, I'm way out of my league in a lot of technical subjects, and so, you know, I definitely, like, Tarun will send some tweet threads, and I'll just sort of like be like, oh,
he's our next. You know my
yep.
You know the kind of people that pique my interest. He's our next guest. So, biggest failure as an adult.
I you know, when I started Alameda up, I didn't know how to manage. I definitely didn't know how to manage when things were going poorly. Went through like a tough period, you know, as 2.5 years ago, led to some employees leaving and you know, a bunch of headaches and a you know, a few wasted months for the company.
I remember you mentioned that once. I'm speaking fast because we're doing rapid fire. I remember you mentioned that once, and I am kind of fascinated because I actually view your ability to form and lead a team. I actually would take the view that that soft skill is one of your biggest strengths.
It's maybe definitely even, come a long
maybe even
way.
Maybe even the biggest. Actually. Really?
Forged in fire.
So when you go home, your parents, I think this is public information. Your parents are hotshot professors. When you go home, are you the big man on campus now?
I think that mostly just because they humor talking about what I do more than I do talking about what they do sometimes. So
have you gotten them to buy Bitcoin?
Not to buy, but I do talk with them quite a bit about work.
Oh, okay. So. Okay. Let's see here. How do you have such a flexible schedule managing three companies? I've been curious about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think basically the answer is that there's a shit ton of things to do, but most of it sort of can happen whenever. And so it's, you know, on the one hand, I'm sort of like triple booked always, but that also means that no time is sort of like, you know, many times are no worse than other times. So
that makes sense, actually. What was the first entrepreneurial thing you did? Anything as a kid?
No, I absolutely. That's not true. I ran a puzzle hunt for high schoolers when I was in high school.
So do you think entrepreneurials, they're made? Is it innate? What do you think?
Yeah, somewhere in between. I think it's innate, but I also think it's something you can sort of activate and cultivate in yourself, or something you just sort of like.
Clearly, a combination of both. That's for sure.
Yep.
Was there pressure to be a lawyer or a professor growing up?
Not at all, lawyer. And parents never wanted that for me.
But you wanted to be a professor at some point.
I did not for any particular reason. It just sort of seemed like the default.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
So you're very extreme with your motivation. Is that related to EA, or is that, where does that come from? That's
a piece of it. It's sort of like I divide into two things. EA is sort of like the ultimate goal, but also it sort of like doesn't tie into day-to-day decisions. And so I sort of have these proximate goals of like, you know, build the best company I can, build the best product, you know, and sort of like all the other sort of like normal things that you think of, which I sort of use to motivate myself, you know, day-to-day.
Any opinion on... you know, I'm a reader, so I frequently don't know how to pronounce things. Nootropics. Any opinion? The brain
yeah.
food.
I think they can be life changing. I also think it's like pretty disappointing what the state of them is. That like there's a whole ton of them, and none of them seem that convincingly that much better than coffee. But I do think that in general, probably half of all people or more should be taking meds of some kind. Because
you know, somehow I knew you would have strong opinions. I knew you would have like a strong, well thought out. This was just instinct. I knew you would. I should ask you that. So hold on. So in our last 2 minutes, I used to try all this. I don't now. I'm just caffeine. But when I was younger, I tried a bunch of different, you know, over the counter, just stuff you could get like vitamins. All the I'll give you an example. Taurine. Taurine. I tried, which made me feel sharper, but it also made me feel it didn't work for my biochemistry. I felt like something was happening, but I was too I almost want to say on tilt, but that's not quite what I mean. I was just too I was off. I was wired but off. Can I ask you if you've tried? Yeah.
So I've tried some, not an enormous number, but a healthy number. And the first thing I'll say is it is sort of disappointing that we haven't just like found the good ones yet. That like a lot of them seem like just not clearly better than coffee. And so I think on when it comes to like kind of the classic stimulants and nootropics, I think modafinil works for a lot of people. I think Adderall works for a lot of people.
Yeah, but then, both of those, modafinil, that's the one the Air Force pilots take, I think, right? Yeah. If they call it like the go pill, if they have to stay awake for a long period of time, if I recall correctly.
Yep. Yep.
Adderall. So these. Yeah. That's more heavy duty.
It's more. It is, and I think that there's doses for everything, but. You know, I think that sort of sometimes the differentiation between these things is overstated, and that things end up in pretty arbitrary categories, all things considered. But that, you know, the truth is they've done lots of studies of Adderall and ADHD and how it can really help people with it. And if you look hard enough at the studies, it starts to become extremely unclear that this is anything specific to ADHD and that it's anything other than it makes you better at concentration. And that's a thing which is quite important to people with ADHD, but that just like everyone actually benefits from it. Although you have to balance that against crashes after and sustainability and tolerance and things like that. So on the one hand, I think there's a bunch of these and some of them work well for some people. It's very hit or miss. And then the other thing I'll say is when you start to veer more in the prescription direction and more in the mental health direction, completely all over the map, completely hit or miss, no theory behind them, not quite none, but it really is just like try 12 things. But you know, everything from stimulants to antidepressants to anti-anxiety meds to sleeping pills. I mean, it sort of depends on who you are and what makes sense, but I think pretty large number of people's lives could be made quite a bit better. And it's certainly like my life is quite a bit better for the things I take, including the maybe most impactful and silliest in some senses, Zyrtec, which is just a standard over-the-counter anti-allergy pill. But I used to have a runny nose, you know, 200 days a year, and now I have it 2 days a year. And it really sucks having a runny nose. Yeah. It's like lose a quarter of your productivity. Like, it's not fun. Mm. And so, like, yeah, did it make, like, 20% more productive in my life? Yeah, I think maybe it did. And, you know, it just worked. I mean, it just solved it, pill a day. So awesome. I think that's sort of like a trivial example, but you know, there's sort of, I mean, I've had issues with insomnia and sleeping pills did wonders. And I tried many, most didn't work, but if you did,
I started laughing because of the picture of you sleeping at work.
turns out that if you're sleep deprived enough, you don't need sleeping pills anymore, but,
okay.
But yeah, highly recommend, finding a responsible, way to see if any of these can help.
Great. Well, thank you so much for your time today, Sam. This was a fascinating first episode of The Feedback Loop with Sino Global. And man, this was great. Thank you so much. Really enjoyed getting to know you even better and learning more about effective altruism.
Of course. Thanks for having me. And good luck. Good luck. Next week, only recommendation is when it comes to chess boxing, I think if you can focus on the boxing, I think you're going to win. I don't think he has a chance. So,
okay. Chess wrestling. Okay. Yeah.
There we go.
Thank you, Sam. Okay. Take care. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right.